Good afternoon, and welcome to the second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And we say it the same way every week.
Yep, we do.
And if I was listening to me, I'd be making fun of me right now, because...
Shit.
Because repetition isn't my thing. But apparently I do it. Oh, my goodness. So, our guest today is Claire Lopez. We have been chatting with Claire since 2016, and I've added those shows for you. We've talked about a lot of good stuff. A lot of, obviously, Middle East stuff, because that is her background. So I was looking at her bio, and it's like, wow. She was a member of the Congressional Task Force on National Homeland Security, which focused on electromagnetic pulse, and served as a director for counterterrorism. That would have led her to work with Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, the late, great Dr. Peter Vincent Pry.
Yep.
And I can't tell you how many times I get an email. I just got a text message the other day from someone who said, I really miss Dr. Pry. And, he was a great patriot and super smart man. And we just really, really loved chatting with him. Big gap in the world of smartness, huh, Claire?
Yeah, absolutely. I was privileged to know Dr. Pry for a number of years, worked with him, as you mentioned there, the task force on EMP. The task force continues to this day. Task force now on national security that includes and really is focused on our electric grid and threats to it, like an EMP. That's electromagnetic pulse attack, either nuclear by an adversary, enemy of the United States, or a coronal mass ejection, a solar flare coming out of the sun could do it too. We sorely miss him. He was brilliant. He was one of a kind. But we try to carry on in his footsteps, even now with the task force on national security.
Yeah, I always think of him on holidays. I remember it was Father's Day one year, and I had scheduled him out quite a weeks prior, and I realized, oh, that's going to land right on Father's Day. And so I emailed him and I said, hey, if you want to bail, that's okay. I get it. Your family might have plans, And he writes back. He goes, well, I knew it was Father's Day. He goes, Father's Day is about fathers. And that is a present that I'm going to have for myself. I'm going to come on and talk about all these things.
Peter.
It was so him. And it's funny, that was really early on. And I thought, that was kind of before we were kind of ha-ha-ha friends on email, right? And after that, he had come on Fourth of July weekend and stuff like that. He's like, he loved having the time to discuss ideas. And
yes, he did.
Yeah, he really...
And, that's where a lot of us, me especially included, learned so much.
Yeah.
I didn't know about EMP before I knew Peter.
No, we didn't either.
But he taught me and many others.
Yeah, and things like that, people like that, and you're included in that list, people who have a lot of information, a two-minute, three-minute, five-minute interview, I'm sorry, but as a listener, I don't learn anything. I learn a little.
It goes by awfully quickly, doesn't it?
Yeah. I learn a little bit, and then I'm thinking, that's a bummer.
Love to have heard more.
Uh-huh. So anyway, just so I don't become one of those people, what's our next stop along the national security update trail that we're having today?
Well, maybe we might turn to Ukraine and Russia. Huh?
Oh yeah.
As developments there, and in your mid-time news announcement there referred to as well.
Okay. Well, what do you think is going to go on there? I mean, if you were a betting woman.
Well, I think the
Hey, you're not a woman.
Oh, I know.
Well, who knows?
Yes, we both got a shot in.
You don't know how I'm identifying today. Just lay off.
Oh yeah, I forgot about that. Sorry.
I think I think the sentiment is that the United States is turning its back on Ukraine. I don't think that's really the case. I think our president is just doing everything he can to get both sides to the negotiating table and get them to negotiate, because they both got their backs up, and neither one of them want to be the first to make, I think, the gesture. What do you think of that?
Yeah, no, you're onto something there, Bill. Exactly. You know, let's begin where we need to begin, and that is that the independent, sovereign nation state of Ukraine was savagely attacked and invaded by a neo-empirical power called Russia, led by a president of Vladimir Putin, whose worst catastrophe, as he thinks of it in his life, was the breakup of the Soviet Union. And his mission in life, as he sees it, is to put back together again, maybe not exactly the old Tsar's Russian Empire or even the Soviet Union per se, but to reconquer and subjugate to Kremlin domination all of the Slavic areas that he can possibly reach in a bid to extend the domination of, as he would see it, Mother Russia, and as he thinks of it, all of these Slavic nations, many of them now NATO members, by the way, we should talk about that, that they should be subjugated to the domination of Moscow. That's what he thinks.
Yeah,
that's how he thinks about it.
I'm a little confused at how he could think that if he can't march into Ukraine and just take it over, how does he propose to take on other Slavic countries that are part of the UN? I mean, that's going to be a whole different ballgame.
NATO.
Member of NATO.
Yeah.
NATO, yeah.
Well, I'll tell you right now, and I've been following this very closely, there are many countries in Europe, Eastern Europe in particular, and even including NATO members, I'll say specifically the Baltics, meaning Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, up there on the edge of the Baltic Sea. Many of these countries are very much concerned that they could be next, whether or not, as they are, members of NATO. The sentiment is that Putin will not stop until he is stopped. We'll recall, of course, it was never just about the Sudetenland, was it? But once Hitler had conquered the Sudetenland, more or less with the acquiescence of the Western powers, Britain, France, others, you know, the invasion route into the rest of then Czechoslovakia was laid open, and on he went. Hitler, on he went. And that is why we see a number of the countries of NATO. The Baltic states are NATO members. So are Sweden and Finland, joined in 2023. So are many of the other countries of Eastern Europe, Hungary and Poland and Romania and Bulgaria and others. You know, even though they're members of NATO, they are worried enough, and this is part of the Trump administration's, I would say, success and priority to prod them all to increase their defense spending as a percentage of GDP. And so now we have Baltic states, Poland, and others looking towards a 5% of GDP spending on defense, which you know they had not done before, and insofar as NATO's concerned, the target goal was 2% of GDP on defense for NATO, and these states are worried enough that they're going beyond that and aiming now all the way up to 5%. The United States, for example, We spend 3 point something, I forget exactly the number, 3 point something percent of our GDP on defense spending. But these are aiming as far as 5%. And places especially like the Baltics, also Finland. I don't know if people know this, but Russia is right now beginning to mass troops and armed forces on the border with Finland.
No kidding.
I don't know if people know that. They are.
Yeah.
And the Baltics, as I've repeated here, are especially concerned. There is a little strip of land. We should mention this. If, I don't know if people can mentally picture this map, the geography there. But the Baltics sit, as I said, on the shores of the Baltic Sea. Both Estonia and Latvia are directly bordering on Russia. Lithuania, the furthest south of them, of the three Baltic states, is bordering on both Poland and Belarus, but also on Kaliningrad. Now, Kaliningrad, as people might know, is this small enclave tucked in between Poland and Lithuania on the edge of the Baltic Sea. And it is Russia. It is Russian territory. Well, if you can take a mental sort of image of the map, between Belarus and Kaliningrad, both of these Russian satraps, right, there is only a short strip. It's called, the Poles call it Suwalki Gap. You'll see it elsewhere as just Suwalki Gap. But in any case, about 100, and, I think it's 175 kilometers long. It runs in a straight line. It is a border line from Belarus to Kaliningrad. If Belarusian forces, under Russia, of course, and Kaliningrad, Russia forces, could take over this gap, this line, the Suwalski Gap, they would completely cut off the Baltic states. Lithuania, Estonia, and Lithuania would be cut off from the rest of NATO to the south, Poland immediately to the south of there. So that is part of the concern. People are looking at that geography. They're looking at the buildup of Russian forces on Finland's border. Everybody knows that, you know, aggressors don't stop until they're stopped.
Right.
Well, they should know that. We have enough history.
Well, those are much smaller countries, so I understand they're a little concerned because they would get crushed by Russia.
Well, they have before.
Yeah.
Remember, of course, they were forcibly incorporated into the Soviet Union after World War I. And they don't forget that. They were never acknowledged. They were never acknowledged as, part of the Soviet Union or conquered. Rather called occupied, just as eastern Ukraine right now is occupied in the Donbas. Parts of the oblasts, those are like provinces, of eastern Ukraine, Donetsk, Luhansk, Kherson, and Zaporizhia in particular, are occupied territories, as is Crimea, occupied, but not acknowledged as Russian.
So The territory that Russia is now occupying, if they come to an agreement to let them keep that and stop the war, does that kind of give them the green light to go attack somebody else and take their territory?
Yeah, of course it does. Of course it does. And then, I mean, think, what sovereign independent nation can just say, you want Donbass, Luhansk, Kherson, and Zaporizhia plus Crimea. You know, just go ahead and put their sovereign national territory and their own citizens and just give them away to the tyrannical occupation.
Yeah, because it's not just ground. It's got people that go with it.
An aggressor invader?
Right, right.
You can't, I mean, would we do such a thing?
No.
What if our West Coast were one day invaded, I don't know, by, let's say, China? And, Washington State, Oregon, California get peeled off, and they're occupied by China. I mean, some would say, well, yeah, okay. But others would say, no, that's America. That's mm-hmm. America. And we don't need some other country in some other place saying, well, let's negotiate and, you know, just tell Idaho and what else, Nevada, Utah, Arizona, they'll be fine. They'll be okay. Just let them have the western states, and, you know, that'll be a ceasefire, and that'll stop the killing.
It's true.
Did we ever even dream of doing such a thing?
No. And you really do have to include that in your kind of in your thought process. You know, bring it back home and look at bargaining off. It's not just land. It's people.
It's the people.
It's people.
You know, do you consign them to subjugation under a tyrannical dictatorship empire called Russia?
Well, bottom line is, even if they were kind of nice, so let's say you're unwilling to think that they're bad guys and you think they're kind of nice, you're not a sack of flour.
No.
You know, they're not your guys. They might
be. They've already kidnapped over 20,000 Ukrainian children.
Yeah, then there's that.
And here comes summer again when they'll grab a bunch more and take them into Russia for summer camp. But they'll never return them. They'll never take them back.
Do they really call it summer camp?
There are actually summer camps, yes.
Yikes.
They really are summer camps. But they take them and they don't return them. And there are NGOs, Ukrainian and others, you know, working all the time to get these kids back home with their families and their parents. But so far they've only managed to, it's a big accomplishment to be able to return about 1,000 of them. But this is what Russia is doing. You know, I talk often in interviews and, you know, when I'm talking to people about the Treaty of Westphalia. I don't know if folks are familiar with this. But
Claire, let's take a really quick break before we do that,
right,
so I don't have to jam it up there.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And our music on this break is a little shout out to our friend, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. And just in case you thought that I picked this song at random, this was his favorite song, which was just so much fun to learn. We always played it for him. These were his two favorites. Our guest today is Claire Lopez. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
That justice is the one thing you should always find. You gotta saddle up your boys, you gotta draw a hard line. When the gun smoke settles, we'll sing a victory tune, and we'll all meet back at the local saloon. We'll raise up our glasses against evil forces, singing whiskey for my men, beer for my horses.
At me, I'm sure she's working for the KGB in this paradise. Ah, cold as ice. Oh, moonlight and vodka takes me away. Midnight in Moscow is sunshine.
I remember the first time I played that one, and he was really quiet, and he goes, that's really reminiscent. So, okay. We have the horrible summer camp where we abduct children. Summer camp is supposed to be fun. Obviously, that's not what's happening. And then they keep them. And then you moved on into the next thing, and I don't want to break that up.
Yeah, so I was going to mention the Treaty of Westphalia. In the early part of the 1600s in Europe was the horrible 30 Years' War. And the principalities and the kingdoms and princedoms of Europe just tore each other apart with huge casualties over that 30 years of the war. At the end of it, 1648, the kingdoms, the kings, the princes of whatever was left of Europe got together in the town of Westphalia, Germany now, and decided we can't do this again. We just cannot do this to ourselves again. They lost, I don't know what it was, 30% or something of the entire population of Europe at the time. We can't do this anymore. And so for the very first time, they sat down and codified an agreement that stated that the core, the key element of the then the European or the world order would be the sovereign, independent nation state with defensible borders. For the very first time, that had never been the understanding before. And so you had kings and warlords and, you know, would-be emperors rampaging across the landscape, invading where they will. But now the independent sovereign nation state was to be the cornerstone of the at least the European order. Now, of course, that's been observed as often in the breach since then as not. But however, that remains still to this day the essence of our world order, that the independent sovereign nation state with defensible borders is the ideal. It's the ideal for our world order. And we're a part of that. We, the United States of America, are a big part of that. And we're vested in that, with our own interests vested in that concept. And that's why it's important that we defend not only our own borders, should be without goes without saying.
Although for 4 years we just suspended that as a concept. But
should, again, the ideal, but also why it is right that we support Ukraine in its fight to remain sovereign, independent, and with defensible borders. It doesn't mean that the United States or anybody else, you know, jumps into a border dispute anywhere in the world. No. But when you've got the largest country in Europe, that's Ukraine, not by population, but by land, geography, invaded, you know, by an aggressor, neo-empirical army, Russia's, which has done this before. We've seen this play out before in Europe, and we see that happen. It is not just to Europe's benefit, to NATO's benefit, because on the other side of Ukraine, to the west, are so many NATO countries that we mentioned earlier. But it is in the defense of that Westphalian ideal of the sovereign, independent nation state that needs defending, because it doesn't defend itself.
Well, you know, you had the League of Nations, which is now the UN. They didn't have really that great a reputation of jumping to the defense of their members. Do you think that'll be the case this time? Do you think they'll drag their feet if Russia goes in a different direction? Or do you think they will step up and stop it?
Well, here's to the credit, I say, of the Trump administration. And the prodding, the pushing by the Trump administration, you know, to the countries of Europe and particularly of NATO, to up their own defense, in their own defense, as well as that of Ukraine. And as I said before, I know that many of these countries, and in particular those closest to the borders of Ukraine or of Russia or its satrap, Belarus, that they have taken alarm, and that under that threat by Russia, by Putin, and the prodding coming from the Trump administration, they are increasing, you know, their own expenditures on their own defense, and doing other things like diversifying the sources of their energy, cutting back on energy imports from Russia, increasing imports, for example, of liquid natural gas from the United States, to sever that dependence on Russian provision of energy to them. Sanctions, willingness to go along with sanctions against Russia, It's banks. Leading, the members of Putin's inner circle, the Kremlin. All of these things, because of, Putin's aggression against Ukraine and because of the very, committed, pushing by the Trump administration for them to do more in their own defense. They're doing it. They're doing it. We talked about, meeting up to as much as the 5% of GDP investment in their own defense. But as well, we've seen, a steady and an unbroken supply of weapons and ammunition and humanitarian supplies, too, from these European countries to Ukraine. I don't think with all of the Russian propaganda, which is incredibly effective across social media and elsewhere, with all of that, I think many people may not realize the extent to which European countries have contributed to Ukraine's defense. And in terms of GDP, because that's how you have to do it, in terms of GDP per country, there are at least five or six European countries that have contributed more to Ukraine than we have.
Right. Right. And do you think Putin sees that as maybe a little stronger sign of unity, that maybe jumping into, one of these other countries might not be a good idea? Or do you think that'll even affect his decision?
I don't know. I mean, that's a debate. And the fear is, of course, that he will not see that as any kind of impediment or deterrent against further aggression. Countries like Lithuania have surged their own troops to the borders. They've closed border crossings. They're moving to call up the reserves, that sort of thing. They're not counting on Putin stopping or seeing himself deterred, even with the unity that we've seen from NATO and other European countries, not seeing, that deterrence taking effect. And in fact, I'll name a plug for a good source of information on this, and that is a retired General Jack Keane's think tank, the Institute for the Study of War. They put out a daily newsletter about the progress of the Russian aggression against Ukraine that's very detailed and very worthwhile if you've got the time to go through it. They do a nice job of providing key points, so if you don't want to read the entire, multi-page thing, you can look at the key points. But in any case, that newsletter has very often relayed in translation statements coming out of the Kremlin, coming out of, Putin and his senior leadership, like Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov or the National Security Council deputy, I guess he is, Dmitry Medvedev, and the one who's sometimes called Putin's Rasputin, Alexander Dugin. Memory is another place that translates those comments. Memory, M-E-M-R-I, Middle East Media Research Institute, Yigal Carmon's very, very useful think tank, I guess it is, but provides the two of them. They provide, other places do too, but English translations of the statements coming out of these leadership figures of Russia. And they're absolutely, at least in the statements, committed to entirely taking over Ukraine, displacing its current government, replacing that government in Kyiv with their own puppet appointees, denying Ukraine its national sovereignty, independence, denying it the ability to set its own foreign policy, whether that policy be looking to the future to join NATO sometime in the future, not now, or accepting aid of any kind, especially military, I guess, from foreign countries like the West, like Europe, like NATO. All of these are absolutely, unbudgeable demands by Putin before he'll even discuss a ceasefire agreement. And we know that there were meetings scheduled last week. Two have been held at Putin's invitation in Turkey. And, of course, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky showed up, and so did American interlocutors, including, I think, our Ukraine envoy, retired General Keith Kellogg, and I think also Steve Witkoff, our other envoy, was there, too. They went to Istanbul, and then Putin got cold feet, and he didn't show up.
Why is that? I mean, he called the whole thing.
Yeah, because I think, I mean, in my own mind, I'm speculating, he thought maybe that Volodymyr Zelensky would not accept. Zelensky accepted immediately, kind of called his bluff.
Oops.
And then he got cold feet. Putin got cold feet and didn't show up. So what we're seeing is, and I think Trump and the administration figures are, our administration, are realizing that, you know, the real impediment to settling this horrific war, it's definitely not in Kiev. It's not with Zelensky. It's not Ukraine. It's Russia. Russia is bent on conquest and domination, and they're not settling for anything less than that at the moment.
I've done zero research on this, but you've done tons. Has Putin ever, you know, actually entered into an agreement? Is there any history of that? Or is this going to be like the maiden voyage?
No, I'll name one. Right after the breakup of the Soviet Union, back in the early 1990s, you know, which, as we said, Putin thinks is the worst catastrophe of his life.
Right.
There was an agreement among Ukraine, Russia, U.S., U.K., might have been one or two more, called the Budapest Memorandum, because that's where it was concluded, in Budapest in Hungary. Budapest Memorandum basically said, Ukraine, if you give up your nuclear weapons, because as a Soviet Socialist Republic of the USSR, Ukraine had Russian nuclear weapons positioned on its territory. And at the breakup, those weapons were still there. And the Budapest Memorandum said, Ukraine, if you give up those weapons, return them back to Russia, we, the rest of the signatories, we pledge your independence, your sovereignty, the defense of your sovereign borders. And by the way, speaking of sovereign borders, under international law, when a former empire breaks up, like Yugoslavia did in the 1990s, say, each unit, each element of that breaks up and goes its separate way, like in Yugoslavia, you had Bosnia-Herzegovina, you had Serbia, you had Montenegro, et cetera, Croatia. Each of those goes its separate way with the borders that it had administratively when still part of the empire. Okay? So that means that when Ukraine broke away, became independent from the former Soviet Union, it went its way with its internationally recognized sovereign borders, and those included not just the Donbas, it included Crimea.
Mm-hmm.
We could talk about Crimea and what it should be and what the people of Crimea wanted to be. But under international law, the country goes its way independently with the borders it had under the former empire. So the Budapest Memorandum guaranteed those borders to Ukraine. And as soon as it was possible, meaning 2014, Putin grabs Crimea in violation of the Budapest Memorandum. And in the same year, 2014, invades the Donbas. As we said before, there are two oblasts there, Donetsk and Luhansk. Additionally, now he's invaded two more, well, more than two more, but Kherson and Zaporizhia and some others, too. So, yeah, he's broken pledges in the past. The Budapest Memorandum is Exhibit A.
He's made them and broken them.
Yeah.
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 Okay. So, if this was your needle to thread, what would, I mean, and, you know, you had whomever at your disposal, who would you send and what would you do?
Well, I think very highly of our envoy to Ukraine, General Keith Kellogg. And I would send the message that together with our NATO allies, we will help to defend Ukraine's sovereignty and its internationally recognized sovereign borders. And I very much support and agree with the minerals deal that the Trump administration has concluded with Ukraine, because under that agreement, but again, once there is a ceasefire, the United States will have a presence on the ground to help develop those mineral resources, including rare earth elements, but also other things like oil and gas, too. So I support the minerals deal or the natural resources deal. I think that's a very good idea. I know that certain countries of Europe, for example, Britain, I think also Sweden, have pledged their own forces to man a ceasefire line, to be a peacekeeping force on whatever line is drawn at the end of hostilities. So I would support all of that. But I would, in the meantime, surge to Ukraine what it needs most. And I would say at the top of that list would be air defenses. They're doing a great job on their own of you know, developing their own defense resources, like a drone industry, for example. But they need more in terms especially of aerial defense. And I would surge those to Ukraine and also impose more and stricter sanctions against Russia and its leading autocrats. Oligarchy comes to mind.
Wait, and, isn't that what we have here? I've seen signs.
Some people would say that, but no, not at all. Not even close.
Not unless you're on a college campus reading protest signs.
We have to take a really quick break.
We're kind of blowing it. We're going to have all the ads at the bottom at the top of the hour. Our guest is Claire Lopez. We're going to come right back with her again. You are listening to We the People. You can find us at WeThePeopleRadio.us.
I pledge allegiance to this flag. And if that bothers you, well, that's too bad. But if you got pride and you're proud, you do. Hey, we could use some more like me and you. Where the stars and stripes and the eagle fly.
I'm sick and tired of people putting it down. If you don't like it here, get the heck out of town. Go and find somewhere you love. It's fine with me. With us, so you're riding with them. Make up your mind which side you stand. If you ask me, this whole world has gone to hell. I speak the truth, but these days the truth won't sell. Longer ride, I give my life for this place called USA.
A little Creed Fisher there for you.
Yeah, there you go.
All right, Claire, what have we left out? Because we do have people in this country, media people, who have said, as our engineer pointed out, you know, Putin's not that bad. Like, why don't we, you know. Why aren't we working with him more?
You know, as I said before, the Russian propaganda machine is incredibly effective. They have, you know, bots and presence all over social media. And people who don't necessarily, you know, swim in this stuff like we do, are taken in. They're taken in by claims that, oh, Putin is a Christian, you know, because he doesn't go for all of that LMNOP stuff. So he's a good man. And, you know, they don't understand the difference, for example, between the Moscow Patriarchy of the Orthodox Russian Orthodox Church and the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, which have separated, as you can well imagine, and why. They don't understand that. And so they're taken in by a lot of the information operations. But, you know, as I recently spoke to another group, it was the North Carolina Republican Women's Federation annual conference where I spoke in, the beginning of May. And the theme of that was that we're living in a time, as I see it, of tyranny versus freedom. And in each one of these cases that we've talked about, and we really didn't even get to talk about, you know, Israel against, you know, the Iranian axis of resistance, as they call it, Hezbollah, Hamas, Houthis, and so forth. But in each of the cases, Iran, you know, the regime of the Ayatollahs against its own people. And then again, Israel being attacked by Iranian proxy, Islamic jihadi proxies. Ukraine being invaded by Russia. Here, right at home, instances hopefully now on the road to correction, but not always. But, you know, as I heard them called somewhere on a newscast somewhere, robes gone rogue. That is, black robes gone rogue. So, I mean, we're fighting the same fight here, tyranny versus freedom. And if we had to sum up all of this and more that we just, you know, didn't get to, China, you know, and you know, the oppression against its own people, impending aggression against, you know, an independent, sovereign Taiwan, all of that falls under this concept, this idea that not just our era, but in every era, really, it's a never-ending battle of freedom versus tyranny.
Yeah, somebody, I mean, you know, I think we all learned this as children, right? You know, if you have more than one kid in your family and you went out trick-or-treating, there was always the big kids versus the little kids and who got the candy bars at the end. And I don't know that ever ends.
Well, it's human nature, I suppose, in some ways. But, you know, some of us here in what we call the free world try to rise to, you know, the better part of human nature. And that would be to defend concepts in our own, you know, constitution, foundational Judeo-Christian principles, although they don't have to be only Judeo-Christian, but of individual liberty, government by consent of the governed, equality of justice under the law, these kinds of principles. They have to be defended in every time and every era. And here we are.
Yeah. Well, you're, you know, a huge percentage of your career was, you know, Middle East type stuff. So when you kind of look at the big picture of the Middle East, do you think they're getting, in general, you know, stronger and bigger, more reined in? I mean, what's the trend line from your vantage point?
Well, I would look to the Iranian regime, the Islamic Republic of Iran, as often called, you know, the head of the snake, or of the octopus, maybe. And it's in a much weakened position right now. Its jihadi proxies, anywhere from Hamas to Palestinian Islamic Jihad, Hezbollah, the Houthis, have all been degraded very seriously, and air defenses in Iran itself that used to defend its nuclear weapons sites like Natanz and Isfahan and so forth have been taken out. The people of Iran themselves, have been fighting for their liberty for 46 years.
Wow.
And they have the right to that liberty, and I think we have we have the responsibility, the obligation to help support them in that. I think now is the time that if that head of the snake were to be taken out, that the people of Iran themselves could and would rise up, you know, for their own liberty and to chart the path to their own future in their own country.
Well, they've had a really significant resistance movement going for quite some time.
Yes, they have.
How do you see them? And it's always interesting to me that Miriam Rajavi is the head of the resistance. You know, it's just kind of fascinating that a woman would be the
absolutely. And that's the whole point.
Yeah, tip of the spear on that whole thing, because there are a lot of people out here on the West Coast. At least you have the Organization of Iranian American Communities. Oh, I always get it wrong. OIAC.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And they're great Americans who really do want their country back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not necessarily so they can go there, but so that maybe all their friends and family and political prisoners and different people, so that they can return their country.
Well, I'll mention one thing that was just announced literally this past week, and that is an upcoming conference, dates not yet established or venue even, organized by the organization, UANI, United Against, United Against a Nuclear Iran, UANI,
okay.
United Against a Nuclear Iran, together with CPAC organization of Mercedes and Schlapp, and that combination are getting together sometime this, I don't know if it's summer, but in coming weeks or months,
okay,
to put together a conference, Matt Schlapp and Mercedes Schlapp of CPAC, together with UANI, a conference to draw together all of the Iranian opposition groups in exile. I don't know any more details than that, but it's just been announced. It's upcoming. Stay tuned.
Nice.
At either of those places, CPAC or UANI. And yes, I have worked with the National Council of Resistance of Iran, been to Paris and met Madame Rajavi multiple times for 20 years. And I would only hope that they might be part of that that conference. But again, they have been on you know, the pointy end of the spear in leading the resistance inside of Iran, and again, as we talked about earlier, you know, infiltrating its nuclear weapons program, bringing out the information about it that we have, otherwise would not have. So, you know, if and when Israel decides for its own survival that it needs to strike against those nuclear weapon sites in Iran, that very well could be the signal that the internal resistance in Iran would take as a signal for a mass uprising and take back their own country under the 10-point plan of Madame Rajavi.
Yes.
At the NCRI website, you can find those 10 points. Democratic, you know, free market capitalist economy kind of principles. They might take that as the signal for themselves.
Well, they have said many.
Rise up and finally take back their country.
They have said many times, privately and on air, that if the U.S. would stay out of it, stop giving Iran money, stop, you know, doing all these different things, because for a while there we were actually just helping them oppress everyone. They said if we would just get out of there, they would be able to pull the pin and make it happen.
They want to do this themselves.
Yes.
They see it as their own responsibility.
They're not asking us to go do it for them.
What they want is backing. They want support. Again, you know, leadership of the United States and other Western, you know, free nations would mean the world to them. But it doesn't necessarily mean boots on the ground at
right.
all. That's not what they want.
And they have said, please don't, actually. Please stop helping.
No.
Claire,
ahead,
we
yeah.
have to run away. It's
all
happened
right.
again. We're going to come back on with you again because now, you know, we're best friends. So thank you so much for being on with us.
You're welcome.
Our guest has been Claire Lopez, and happy Memorial Day, and thank you to our service members currently
you,
on the ground.
Thanks, Bill and Aaron both.
You know there ain't no rest for the wicked. Money don't grow on trees. We got bills to pay, we got minds to feed. There ain't nothing in this world for free. I know we can't slow down, we can't hold back. Though you know we wish we could. I know there ain't no rest for the wicked until we close our eyes for good.